Buenas noches, amigos y amigas. This is Brandalismus, every second Friday of the month, and this is a very special Friday, a previous moon eclipse, Friday 13. Join us this evening to continue with the esoterica research, and we're going to go deep into the part 5 of the pollinating consciousness in plants and culture, from the library of Esoterica. And in pollinating consciousness, we're going to join into the Ben's talk. Ben's talk. The Beanstalk, Plants in Literature. The clearest way into the universe is through a forest of wilderness. Say John Muir, author, naturalist, and environmentalist advocate. He wrote that in a journal collection that were after published as John of the Mountains, the unpublished journals of John Muir. The entire history of written words owns adapt to the plant world. First and foremost in the development of paper itself, ancient Egyptian scrolls were inscribed on the pressed pith of the papyrus, a flowering aquatic plant which still grows today, tall and green along the Nile, also known as the paper plant. Some of the oldest known writings of papyrus date back from the 4th millennium BCE, later in the 2nd century China, a process of pressing the pulp of certain trees and plant materials developed eventually, evolving into the paper we know today. Now, most often manufactured using the cellulose fibers pressed from a variety of tree wood as well as grasses and plants such as cotton and hemp. Early inks were also created from botanical matter, often utilizing the soot of burnt wood. A dense charcoal mixed with other materials and minerals. The ancient Mayas documented their histories in a remarkable, durable, vibrant blue ink which took its bright indigo hue from the leaves of the Central America leafy shrub called añil. In cultures across the planet, the plant world has enabled us to tell stories in durable, tactile form, allowing our stories to be passed one from one generation to the next. Nature as setting, symbolic plot point and narrative foundation has also remained a constant in literature and storytelling. Perhaps on spine, soot ink, it was first put to press the papyrus page. Plants and flowers, herbs and trees all play pivotal roles in our mythic sagas, biblical parables, Arthurian legends, and in indigenous folk tales across cultures. Great writers, past and present, have always looked to the botanical world for inspiration, weaving innumerable references to the natural realm through their poetry, plays, and prose. Shakespeare, for example, raised in the verdant expanse of the English countryside, wove a leaf-green narrative thread through his prolific output of work, mentioning plants, herbs, and flowers in so many of his writings that his words have since inspired countless gardens planted in his name. In the last century, Shakespeare gardens have become a popular feature of public parks through the UK and USA. Verdant plots planted with all the botanicals mentioned by the bard between his poems and in the intricate dialogues of his plays, from Romeo and Juliet's A Rose by Any Other Name to Ophelia's lyric listing of symbolic herbs and flowers in her speech with Laertes from Hamlet. In 1906, the British illustrator Walter Crane published Flowers from Shakespeare's Garden, a posse from plays celebrating Shakespearean botanicals with a collection of elegant and ornate botanical illustrations. Crane's own creative work often embraced nature as muse, most notably in the images he created to accompany children's literature, as well as in his 1899 publication, A Floral Fantasy in an Old English Garden, which features Crane's anthropomorphized flower and herb drawings, a surreal and fantastical world of plants transformed into people. Crane's image also illustrated the famous stories of the Brothers Grimm, his work showcasing the author's penchant for natural symbolism in many of the great and enduring Grimm fairy and folk tales. Plants, fruits, and trees play a central role, from the evil queen's magical and malevolent poison, apple, in Snow White, to Cinderella's enchanted pumpkin transforming into an ornate carriage and the menacing and labyrinthine forest in which Hansel and Gretel lost their way. In 1734, English children's tale Jack Spriggins and the Enchanted Bean. Jack plants his magic seed and is rewarded with a beanstalk that towers high enough to allow himself to access to the giant castle in the clouds. In the famous French story of La Belle et la Bête, first published in 1740, it is the illicit plucking of a prized rose that first sets into motion the debt owed by beauty to the beast. Plants as gatekeepers into enchanted realms have been present in children's literature through the last few centuries. From the magical elder of poppy fields of the outskirts of Oath's Emerald City to the caterpillar in Lewis Carroll, Alice Adventures in Wonderland. Sitting sage-like atop his mushroom cushion, blowing smoke rings between languorous stalks from his hookah. In the 20th century, Frances Hodgson Burnett's immensely successful 1911 novel, The Sacred Garden, told the tale of a neglected orphan girl that finds unexpected solace and friendship between a wild and mysterious garden. In artist and author Shel Silverstein, 1964, children's classic The Giving Tree, a lyrical illustrator narrative, traces as a boy's lifelong relationship with a kind, generous, and inexhaustibly selfless apple tree. And in Maurice Sendak, Where the Wild Things Are, published a year prior, young Max Bedram is transformed into a verdant jungle island where nature runs rampant and Max reigns over a world of wild things. Children's literature is often a world where nature is an inherent piece of the narrative, where grassy fields are soft with sunlight, fairies float like dust, moats among the daisies and dandelions, and where the woods are dark and full of mystery, a place where adventures await. Poetry, of course, has often placed nature on the highest of literary pedestals. Our emotional connection to the earth, the subject of innumerable odes, the 13th century Sufi mystic and poet Rumi often explored the innate connection between the spiritual and natural realm in his work. The traditional Japanese form of haiku often celebrates the botanical world, as in the 16th century poet Basho, many delicate laments to the beauty of the cherry tree. John Keats, Percy Bysshe Shelley, William Wordsworth, and other English writers of the Romantic movement of the late 18th and 19th century often populated their work with scenes and symbols drawn from natural world. In a spare sunlight bedroom of mid-18th century New England, the great poet of stillness and solitude, Emily Dickinson, was known to sit carefully pressing hundreds of flowers and plants into leather-bound scrapbooks. These botanical samples were plucked from the world just outside her door and preserved for future creative consultations. Dickinson's communion with nature was intense and profound, a relationship that seems rooted even more deeply than those the poet shared with her family and friends. For Dickinson, nature was an infinite source of inspiration, a well that never ran dry. Another poet enamored with the beauty of botany was the exuberant and impassioned Walt Whitman. While Dickinson approached her muse with tender trepidation, Whitman sung of nature with a joyous and primal whole. In his epic collection, Leaves of Grass, first published in 1855, Whitman celebrates the joys of both the body and the natural world with an unbridled passion. The series of poems, A Love Letter to All Things Living, in his poem Song of the Open Road 6, Whitman famously states, "Now I see the secret of the making of the best person. It is to grow in the open air and to eat and sleep with the earth." Later, poets such as the beat revolutionary Allen Ginsberg will take up Whitman's mantle, praising a perfect beauty of a sunflower in his well-known poetic ode Sunflower Sutra, published in 1955. Naturalist Diane Ackerman's 1990s book, A Natural History of the Senses, the natural world is explored through each sense, taste, touch, smell, and sight, all in delirious, delicious detail. Ackerman's predecessors, the American naturalist, transcendentalist, and author Henry David Thoreau, famously immortalized his bucolic homestead set on the wooded edge of a shimmering Massachusetts pond with his groundbreaking Walden or Life in the Woods. Part memoir and part spiritual and political statement, the book, first published in 1854, documents the 2+ years spent in his small self-built cabin experimenting the book's opening pages. "I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what I had to teach and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived." Thoreau's mentor and friend, the poet Ralph Waldo Emerson, had by then already established the core tenets of the transcendentalism-dedicated connection with the natural realm in his famous 1836 essay, aptly titled Nature. Controversial in its time, the essay suggests that the divine is an inherent part of the natural world. In the woods, Emerson writes, is perpetual youth between this plantation of God, a decorum and sancti ring perennial festival is dressed, and the guest sees not how he should tire of them in 1,000 years. In the woods we return to reason and faith. Later, the essayist and adventurer John Muir will again celebrate the majesty of the natural world, his works inspiring the first formations of America's national park system through colorful, exuberant accounts of his cathartic adventure through California and the western edge of the United States. In 1968, the writer Edward Abbey will follow Muir's lead with the cheerfully misanthropic accounts of his time as a park ranger in the autobiographical Desert Solitaire, A Season in the Wilderness. Wilderness is not a luxury but a necessity of the human spirit, and as vital to our lives as water to as water and good bread, he continues. A civilization which destroys what little remains of the wild, the spare, the original, is cutting itself off from its origins and betraying the principle of civilization itself. Abbey's works expand upon the environment and ecologically centered writings of the scientist and author Rachel Carson, whose in 1962 classic Silent Spring essentially launched the environmental movement in the US and abroad. In 2013, biologist and scholar Robin Wall Kimmerer released Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teachings of Plants, her work igniting discussions around traditional indigenous methods of caring for the land. Again and again, nature in all her diversity captivates writers, offering authors inexhaustible insights, a world of color and light, symbolic cycles of life, death and rebirth, connections that simultaneously ground the reader to set them free. Through our shared history of Earth on Earth, plants have offered us not only the means with which to tell our tales through ink, papyrus, and paper, but also the inspiration that supports so many of our shared narratives. The late poet Mary Oliver, who captivated readers with her simple yet profound statements on nature as means of redemption, often offers thanks in her work for the immense and selfless generosity of the botanical realm. In her 2004 book, Blue Iris, Poems and Essays, she writes, and over one more set of hills along the sea, the last roses have opened their factories of sweetness and are giving it back to the world.
Zygazunt means be healthy. Zygazunt means be well. Zygazunt has a meaning that no
other... Plants and as a muse. Plants as muse. Nature and contemporary culture. When you take a flower in your hand and really look at it, it's your world for the moment. I want to give that world to someone else. Most people in the city rush around, so they have no time to look at the flower. I want them to see if whether they want to or not. Words of Georgia O'Keeffe from an interview with the New York Post in the 1946. Plants and nature have been the artist muse since the earliest cave paintings, depicting mushrooms, cactus and flowers, powdered minerals, pigments rubbed onto stone in the flicker of firelight. Nature is inspiration across all mediums and art forms. Word to page, ink to canvas, the snap of the shutter. There are certain artists for whom nature was a central and continually evolving motivation to manifest work. Artists we immediately align with imagery of flowers or plants, trees or gardens. Van Gogh's Sunflowers, Vivian and Bright, the artist documenting the natural realm with a vibratory, slightly hallucinogenic immediacy. There is Monet in his garden at the Giverny growing wildflowers beside roses, crowning wine, and amid tiny shrubs, a garden painted more than planted, organized with the beautiful cacophony of an artist's palette. There is the symbolist Paul Gauguin immersed in his sunlight and palms. French Polynesian reservoirs and the luminous floral explorations of Henri Matisse once quote a saying, "There are always flowers for those who want to see them." Centuries prior, in the 15th century, the Italian painter Giuseppe Arcimboldo created playful detailed paintings by anthropomorphizing plants, fruits and flowers into figures in a series of works that set the natural realm at their center. Later, the Surrealist movement will approach nature with the same whimsical eye, playing with size and form, mutating the physical world into multiple dimensions of their own. In Salvador Dalí's visions, a rose hovers immense and sensual over vast plains of dry grass. In Dorota Stanning's dreamlike imagery,